This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts just to not miss any breaking updates on the stories that we follow and discussions as well. You can get a commercial-free version of it through Apple Podcasts right now. Even try that for 3 days free if you like over there. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Today, we're going to be talking with retired FBI special agent and former chief of counterintelligence and behavioral analysis, Robin Drieke. We're going to dive into the Alex Murdaugh case a little bit deeper and the psychology of what on earth is going on here. How did an individual that seemed to have everything be the biggest fish in a small pond, have a loving family, wife, kids, to eventually allegedly murdering his wife and son, stealing millions from the firm that his family built, destroying a dynasty, and several other things that just get deeper and darker the more you peel back the onion. But the first thing I want to ask, Robin, and this, I think, is really talking about behavioral analysis, is the son, the one surviving son. He's been in court the last handful of days, Buster Murdaugh. What on earth is going through the mind of this individual right now? Literally, his world blown apart. Allegations of the worst possible things you could have against your father, Alex. And he's there. And I don't know if he's supporting his father or if he's just there just because obviously this involves his whole life. Based on your history of behavioral analysis and expertise, give us some insight there as to the trajectory that that individual is going to be going down during this trial and after.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack on that one. You said a key word in there, though, that I think is really important for people that are going through any sort of trauma, especially one as severe as he's going through, and that is finding purpose and meaning in life. You know, like, where do you go from there? And this goes to the difference between someone who becomes a victim and a wound collector, like these murderers and people that do wrong by others do, because they're wound collectors, they're seeing themselves as victims, and it's escalating to a point where they're going to take retribution on others. Or you can do something about it. You can take the spin on life that, all right, it is what it is. What am I going to do with this to benefit someone else? How am I going to serve a greater purpose? And so I think it's really going to come down to this young man's decision of that. And most importantly, who's left in his life, in his circle, his mentors, his guides, his counselors. There's got to be a great team behind this, because you're right, it's completely unraveled what he has perceived as normal and baseline. And the most important thing that we all seek, safety.
And that's the thing with someone like him, his normal growing up was really not normal. I mean, it was this family dynasty, if you will. And for the most part, for what we understand, you know, he thought everything was fine and good until everything started to unravel for his father. His family, essentially, as we've heard it put many ways, was the law of the area. With the trial taking place now in the area and his family that had so much control. With that being said, do you think there are still elements of that family control that play a role when it comes to this trial, with those long, deep-rooted connections that seem to have so much power for so much time?
There is no doubt. You know, as I've said it before, just now, and then also on your last episode, you know, that feeling of safety that we all crave as human beings, which is the bedrock of trust, is really critical in every situation with everyone. And when you have a family that's controlling a large swath of area, they establish that normal and they establish what safety is. And if you go against that, that can be very scary. Seating a jury in this, I know it was challenging for them to do because of just that, the fear factor of who's connected to who, who's still on so-and-so's side. I mean, those kind of things really play majorly. And back to the son briefly. yes, when you're in the midst and surrounded by behaviors, those behaviors look normal to you. But in reality, what's probably going to happen, he's going to have a lot of reflection over the years and saying, huh, hindsight is 2020. And I guarantee you, if you're in a situation surrounded by people that make you feel unsafe and you're constantly reading their verbal and nonverbal behaviors to see what's coming next, you become highly attuned to it. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he goes into some sort of line of work where he is actually serving people to understand people greater.
How do communities like this continue to exist, essentially? I'm talking how things were prior to Murtaugh being arrested and them digging into the things that they were involved in, the power that they had in over the community. Over, I mean, for example, the cover up, the way that the boat accident took place, and how it was, you know, almost untouchable in terms of his son being going and getting in much trouble whatsoever because of who he was. At this day and age, where everything is somewhat transparent, they can't just live in a bubble anymore, and the local law is all that there is when you do have federal authorities and such. I mean, how common are these sort of things in smaller communities today, and are there ways of breaking that up with larger organizations like the FBI and such?
You know, I these things will always exist in society, because as long as you have mankind, there will be people. And I can't sit here and clinically diagnose him as a narcissist, but in general, narcissistic behavior is at the root of a lot of these things, where you have someone who's a master of understanding and digging deep to understand the needs, wants, dreams, aspirations, priorities, and pain points of others to use them as leverage against them. That's what master manipulators do. Mm-hmm. And in this case, these types of individuals will do just that. So in the entire network of people they need in their life, and especially if it's a dynasty, you start understanding those pain points of those people around you. You intentionally do things to have dirt on people to use as leverage, whether it's stated or just implied. And then when you actually have individuals that are part of the legal system, so they know the legal system, they know the gray lines, they know the nuance of the law, they're able to help and guide in that area. And then also, when you actually know the limited resources of a law enforcement department, or whether it's the FBI, locals, or state, you know they're not going to go after everyone and everything, because they just don't have the resources for it. So you want to, they're going to ride that edge between being the ones you want to go after and the ones they're not going to go after. So it's a balancing act, and it's what these cult leaders, because that's what they basically do. You know, there's a great book in Robert Greene's book, 48 Laws of Power, that talks about how to form a cult. This is it.
That really is a good way of putting it, in some of these smaller communities where it is very cult-like, the way and the rules that are followed. You know, you'll go there and like, well, in these parts, here's how we do things. And it may seem kind of backwards and not necessarily what we think of cult in terms of like David Koresh or Nexium or something like that, but it is operating almost on the same sort of principles in some communities.
It's centralized power.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. That's what cults are. They're centralized power and use of coercion through manipulative means, mostly covert. You know, a lot of these levers of influence that are used against people aren't widely known, and you don't need many of them against many people to form that cabal around it.
When you have a community like this, and from the outside looking in, especially if one is not part of those communities, doesn't necessarily have the experience or the time spent in those areas to fully understand and feel what it's like there, we can look at this and think, oh, okay, they got the guy that was influencing decision-making in the courts, that was influencing the police, and now that'll all change, and now the community's free. Is that really how it works, though? Or is this kind of a situation where, well, that man's down, and inevitably, because everyone's so conditioned to operate in those ways, that another ends up taking power? Almost like you look at some Middle Eastern countries and such that had very power-hungry dictators and things of that nature, where, well, we knocked one down, and look who came up next.
Yeah. It really comes down to, and you've highlighted it really well, comes down to the type of leader that's going to step forward in the vacuum. And if there is a vacuum or not a vacuum. And you hit great examples, you know, people even like Vladimir Putin right now. Everyone says, you know, hey, if we just get rid of Putin, you know, the whole thing will go away. And No, it won't. He's surrounded by a lot of Putins just like him that are part of that whole, again, that I used that word before, a cabal of just one think, one way, my way. And so luckily, I'm the supreme optimist always. And our form of government is really fantastic. It's the great experiment. And that is when someone has an inspiring message, story, problem-solving ability, and they're going to challenge things and move forward, they have an election and they do it. You know, and so there's always movement forward. Things generally don't stay the same in our country just because of the way our political system works. And so if you have a strong leader that steps up, especially when there's a community that's hurting and in shock, you know, that one person or even team of people can really do a lot of great benefit to that community, as well as become an inspiring story to model for the rest of us.
When you look at the Murdaugh story, Alex Murdaugh specifically, and the spectacular fall from, I don't know if grace is even the right word, because I don't know how far back his story goes of nefarious intent. We know what we know, but one who seems to have these sort of personality traits and personality disorder, so to speak, we've traced it back so far, but something like this, I'm guessing, goes far beyond just stealing money from clients and the maid falling down the stairs. One would think this is probably a way an individual would have operated for quite some time. Do you feel or think that if the digging continues, there will be more to be found on this individual that may even go into places where it's not even prosecutable anymore because it goes beyond the timelines?
Most likely. Very few of us become who we are today when a switch is flipped. You know, it's a progression from our origins. Matter of fact, even on my show, just talking to people, and I always ask that question, you know, what sparked who you are today? And It always goes back to those formative years between roughly the ages of 5 and 9 and the things we're exposed to. Yes, our genetics and biology play a lot into this and where chemistry in our brain works, but our learned behaviors, the things we observe around us, an acceptable behavior that we both observe and then is tolerated in ourselves, really forms who we later become. And so, yeah, I would be hard-pressed to think you wouldn't see abnormal social behavior at an earlier age in earlier situations where people start testing the waters to see what I can get away with, see what's acceptable by the people around me in the community and even in my own family and circle.
How does one get, though, from stealing money from clients, stealing money from his own firm, you know, things that are very large crimes that you know are very prosecutable and have very serious consequences, to the allegations of literally, it's harsh, but it's true when we look at how this has been described now, literally blowing his son's brains out, literally gone out of his body, and then shooting his wife. The allegations are that, or the motive possibly could be that he wanted sympathy for everything else that was piling up on top of him. But how does an individual go from stealing money, things of that nature, more white collar, to killing your family that you supposedly loved community-wise when they were seen together? There really wasn't a lot of signs, and I don't know that there's been a lot of evidence of any sort of abuse or things of that nature to his family. But then suddenly this is the option, this is the choice of, this is the best thing to kill them?
Total lack of empathy and the ability to think that you're above the law, you're above everyone, and that you are the decider of life. It is, again, I can't sit here, you know, as a third party and diagnose that level of psychopathy, but sure, to have that lack of empathy is profound. And as my friend Dr. Chris Mahandy said in his books, you know, that is one broken brain.
And it's a scary thing to think. I think one of the most scary is how long one can go on putting on the show to the outside of, look, everything's great. My family believes that I love them. It appears that this is all good and well, and we're this wonderful, powerful family, to being able to literally pull the trigger and do something like that.
These high levels, I have seen amazing high level psychopathy with individuals, because when you are, I mean, think about this, when you are a pure predator, because that's what this individual is. It's a pure predator mindset. It's a pure predator genetic coding, where all you're doing is looking at the world around you as prey. And prey that's going to serve your needs of survival, feeling safety, and running everything, you know, being the alpha male. So that is where it all comes from. You know, so you think back to an African safari, you know, when you look around the water hole, you know, the lion can sit right next to you and make you feel like $1 million because he's not eating you today. But if he needs you tomorrow, you're dead and there's not a thought about it. I mean, it's just that's the way these high level lack empathy individuals operate.
It's almost in many ways a very primal instinct, a very primal way of thinking, as if their brain did not develop the way many others have into a social setting and understanding and following the rules of society and social norms. They just seem to almost be more archaic in their way of thinking, or not as evolved in many ways.
It's definitely primal. There is no doubt about that.
Robin Drake, thank you for joining us. Robin, a retired FBI special agent and chief of counterintelligence behavioral analysis. Always a pleasure to hear your insight into this case as the trial continues to move forward. We'll continue to cover this case for you, including trial audio. We had opening statements for you yesterday, and we'll be posting audio from the trial so you can listen to it in your own leisure in its entirety, day by day as it goes on right here on the Hidden Killers podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of that. You can get a commercial-free experience through Apple Podcasts right now. Even try that for 3 days free. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod for more on this case and other commentary throughout the day. My name is Tony Bruschi. Until next time, for all of us at Hidden Killers and True Crime Today, thanks for listening.